Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sean Eldridge, founder and president of Stand Up America, who talks about a coalition of groups that are organizing to protect this November's election results, as Donald Trump suggests he'll dispute the outcome if he loses. Daniel Balson of Amnesty International USA, who assesses the damage being done by the Trump regime's imposition of sanctions on the International Criminal Court. And David Vine, professor of political anthropology, who summarizes a report that he co-authored, which finds that at least 37 million refugees were created since the U.S. launched its war on terror after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Russia is involving itself in the growing energy dispute between Turkey and Greece in the Mediterranean. Moscow's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited Cyprus and promised to engage in talks in an attempt to settle the dispute over regional energy rights within a legal framework. Russia, which has good relations with both Turkey and Cyprus, was asked by Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiadis to intervene in the Mediterranean crisis. Greece and Turkey have faced off against each other in recent weeks as Turkish fossil fuel survey vessels and drill ships continue to prospect for gas in waters where Greece and Cyprus claim exclusive economic rights. In a show of force, Greece and Turkey are both conducting military exercises in the disputed Mediterranean region, even as the European Union calls for dialogue. Meanwhile, Russia is holding its own military exercises in the eastern Mediterranean disputed zone as the Trump regime suspended a 33-year-old arms embargo against the internationally recognized Greek government in Cyprus. Foreign Minister Lavrov accused the U.S. of trying to stir up trouble in the eastern Mediterranean, claiming that Washington is trying to pit countries in the region against each other and to pursue the course of those who are not with us are against us. More evidence has emerged regarding President Donald Trump's failed leadership during America's lethal COVID-19 pandemic, as journalist Bob Woodward released tapes where Trump is heard admitting to downplaying the health crisis, even as he acknowledged the extreme danger posed by the virus. Thus far, the Trump regime has not supported mass coronavirus testing, which would need to be coordinated by federal, state, and local governments. According to the New Yorker magazine, scaling up testing would require a central role for the federal government to coordinate testing protocols and expand capacity for rapid and effective COVID-19 testing, similar to programs that have been successfully implemented in industrial nations, including South Korea and the United Kingdom. The mismanaged COVID-19 pandemic has killed more than 193,000 Americans since March and has exposed major defects in the U.S. for-profit healthcare system. Testing protocols in the U.S. are unnecessarily complex, often requiring a doctor's referral to secure insurance coverage. But the city of San Francisco serves as a model for how to implement low-cost, rapid universal coronavirus testing, restrict mass gatherings, suspend non-essential travel, and expand work-at-home options. As the New Yorker noted, while cities like Los Angeles have exploded with COVID-19 cases, San Francisco has kept the coronavirus relatively contained. Many inner-city neighborhoods across America and cities like Richmond, Virginia, have become heat islands with few parks or green spaces, one of many negative consequences resulting from the redlining of communities of color. As a result, the temperature in poor neighborhoods are more than 5 degrees hotter than in white middle-class enclaves. During the 1930s, black and immigrant neighborhoods were often classified as hazardous for real estate investment by the federal government. Residents were denied access to federally backed mortgages and credit, fueling a cycle of disinvestment. Today, redlined neighborhoods in dozens of cities still have fewer parks and trees and are sites of large paved surfaces which radiate greater heat. Extreme heat waves kill over 12,000 people each year in the U.S. In Denver, the New York Times reports parks were intentionally placed in white wealthier neighborhoods, which often blocked the construction of affordable housing. In Baltimore, polluting industries were more likely to be cited in communities of color. In the next few decades, the number of days with deadly heat waves could double as a result of climate change. For decades, cities across the U.S. rarely prioritized racial equality when designing their climate plans. But that's beginning to change as officials in Denver, Houston, and Richmond are paying much closer attention to racial inequality as they design plans to adapt to global warming. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
This November's important presidential and congressional election will be conducted during the worst public health crisis in 100 years. While millions of Americans are relying on absentee ballots to cast their vote as they safeguard their health, Donald Trump and the Republican Party are mounting legal challenges in many states in an effort to make it more difficult to vote by mail. At the same time, Louis DeJoy, a Trump GOP megadonor, was appointed Postmaster General and has implemented new directives at the U.S. Postal Service that dramatically slowed down mail delivery, jeopardizing on-time ballot delivery. As public opinion polls consistently find Mr. Trump losing to former Vice President Joe Biden in both national and battleground state surveys, the president appears ever more desperate. Mr. Trump has repeatedly and falsely charged that mail-in ballots are riddled with fraud and regularly suggested that he may dispute the election results that he claims will be rigged against him if he should lose. Your reporter spoke with Sean Eldridge, founder and president of the group Stand Up America. Stand Up America and Indivisible are leading a coalition of some 90 advocacy and grassroots organizations that have joined together to protect the election results should Donald Trump contest the election outcome. Here he explains how the coalition is mobilizing millions of Americans to fight for democracy if Trump refuses to concede after losing.
Earlier this year, Stand Up America partnered with Indivisible to launch Protect the Results, which is a coalition now of more than 90 organizations across the country who are working together to plan and to be prepared to mobilize if Trump were to refuse to concede, if he were to try to declare victory prematurely, or if you were trying to in any way undermine the results of the election. And, you know, the reason we launched this project is because of what we've seen over the last 3.5 years. We know that Trump has abused his power to demand foreign election interference in our politics. We know that he has lied about voter fraud and particularly about vote by mail on a daily basis. And we know that he has declared that the election is rigged before it has even taken place. So our view is we can't bury our heads in the sand. We can't pretend this isn't happening. We have to be prepared if Trump were to escalate his attacks on our democracy even more. And I think if you look at what Trump is doing right now, lying about vote by mail, declaring that the election is rigged, he's pretty clearly laying the groundwork to dispute these election results. You know, never in modern American history have we had to worry about a president not respecting the peaceful transition of power in our country, but we have to worry about that right now. So we're sounding the alarm that the threat that Trump poses is very real, and that our members and that all Americans need to be ready not only to make a plan to vote, to participate and vote safely this year, but that the work might not end on Election Day, and that we might have to mobilize to protect our democracy if Trump were to not accept the results of the election. So we have this coalition of more than 90 organizations, and we're putting together a national network and a national plan to mobilize and to take to the streets if necessary to push back against any of Trump's attempts to undermine the election results and to make sure we protect our democracy.
We have more Trump threats that appear to be of a violent nature. Trump on more than one occasion is
called out armed militias and military veterans, as well as police and even motorcycle gangs, to keep him in power. Michael Caputo, a Trump loyalist and newly appointed spokesperson at the Department of Health and Human Services, recently said, when Trump refuses to step down at the inauguration, the shooting will begin. And he advised Trump supporters to buy ammunition for your guns. There's more violent language coming out of Trump and his supporters as we get closer to this election. What is your concern beyond the legalisms, the lawyers, and what our elected officials may do in response to Trump not stepping down? Apart from all that, what about the threat of violence here?
Yeah, well, it would be a little crazy not to be concerned. You know, with Protect the Results, with our work at Stand Up America, we are very focused on peaceful protests, peaceful mobilization. I believe in the power of the American people, and I believe in the power of peaceful protest and how it has, you know, changed our government for good over the last couple of centuries. So we are focused on peaceful protest because I think that is what is going to get the attention, the positive attention of decision makers, of election officials, of those who might be being pressured by Trump to do the wrong thing. The violence that I'm concerned about is the violence that we've already seen from this White House. You know, look, we've seen this White House deploy the military to the streets. We've seen them gas peaceful protesters for a photo op. So we know already what they are capable of doing and how far they are willing to go. You know, that said, I think that the American people rising up if necessary, taking to the streets in unprecedented numbers, making it very clear to state legislatures, to governors, to Mitch McConnell, to everybody in this country who might feel pressured by Donald Trump, I think mass mobilization can work and it matters. We've seen that a number of times in the last 3.5 years. So the threats of violence are completely reckless. They are threatening to undermine our political system even further. But it's why organizations like ours are focusing on peaceful protest, peaceful mobilization. And I think and I hope that those who are calling for violence are the extreme outliers here.
That was Sean Eldridge, founder and president of Stand Up America. Learn more about the organizing now being done by the nationwide Protect the Results Coalition by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In early September, the Trump administration sanctioned two members of the International Criminal Court, or ICC, in an attempt to disrupt their investigations into alleged U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. The sanctions, which target the ICC's head prosecutor and head of jurisdiction, block access to their U.S. assets and restrict commercial and financial dealings with U.S. persons. The ICC was created by the Rome Agreement, which was adopted by over 100 nations in 1998 and came into force in 2002. While more than half the countries in the world on all continents are members, the largest nations such as China, Russia, the U.S., India, Pakistan, and Myanmar, where human rights violations are rampant, are not members. The ICC is a court of last resort to bring justice to people who would otherwise have no recourse. While the court has been criticized by some for focusing disproportionate attention on rights violations in Africa, it's pursued important cases on other continents as well. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Daniel Balson, Advocacy Director for Europe and Central Asia with Amnesty International USA. Here he explains how the court works and why the action of the Trump regime is so concerning.
So the International Criminal Court is exactly what it sounds like. It's a criminal court, essentially of last resort. Its mandate is to try the gravest violations of human rights that take place. That includes the crime of genocide, crimes of aggression, and other extremely grave crimes against humanity. It exists essentially to insert itself in cases where local jurisdictions, other state parties, and other governments are either unwilling or unable to bring justice to victims. And the jurisdiction that it claims, jurisdiction on the territory of countries that are state parties. So this is relevant in the case of our discussion today. Afghanistan is a state party.
And our discussion today revolves around the possibility of bringing charges against U.S. personnel for crimes committed in Afghanistan. Is that right?
In a sense. So the International Criminal Court is investigating human rights violations and grave crimes that have taken place in Afghanistan. Now, this includes crimes committed by all parties to the conflict, including non-state actors such as the Islamic State, the Taliban. This includes the government of Afghanistan, and this could potentially include U.S. government actors such as U.S. military, U.S. intelligence agencies. The court has not officially come out and said, you know, these are the specific crimes we're looking at. These are the specific individuals we suspect of having committed crimes. They have not charged anyone, but they are looking at really all crimes that have taken place without giving or offering impunity to one particular actor or the other. And the U.S. could potentially be implicated in this, yes.
The U.S. never joined the International Criminal Court over the course of two Democratic and two Republican administrations. But the Trump administration seems to have gone even further in its opposition. Can you explain?
Sure. So a few months ago, essentially, the Trump administration passed an executive order. And the executive order gave the president, in conjunction with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of the Treasury, the power to sanction individuals from the International Criminal Court. What you saw approximately a week and change ago is the Trump administration then effectuate that power. They declared two individuals, the chief prosecutor, Fatwa Bensouda, and her deputy, as sanctioned individuals, squarely for their work for the International Criminal Court and in support of international justice. It's sort of important to mention the gravity of this action. U.S. government sanctions and the sanctions program, these are really programs that are designed to target the worst of the worst. They're typically deployed against narco traffickers, international terrorists, weapons of mass destruction proliferators, really some of the worst and most nefarious actors in the international arena. So for them to be deployed against essentially prosecutors, which is what they are, individuals who are staffing and supporting the International Criminal Court, is a stunning escalation.
Are there any ways to combat Trump's decision?
I would argue that there are two. First of all, I think a lot of eyes are now turning to Congress. I mentioned that there is skepticism of the International Criminal Court in Congress. That's true in certain quarters. At the same time, very few members of Congress would independently support and authorize this use of a sanctions mechanism that Congress authorized the president to have to use that powers against the International Criminal Court. There's not a huge appetite in the legislative branch to misuse and abuse the sanctions mechanism to target prosecutors for international justice. So it's imperative that Congress speak out. And then all eyes should be turning to Rome Statute signatories that have the power to challenge this decision. So it's important for countries that are state party to the Rome Statute in the ICC and that object to this decision, and this the number of such countries is quite substantial. It's important for these countries to express their concern, their dissent with this decision, both privately and through public channels as well.
That was Daniel Balson, Advocacy Director for Europe and Central Asia with Amnesty International USA. Learn more about the Trump regime's imposition of sanctions on the International Criminal Court by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Nineteen years ago, nearly 3,000 Americans died in the al-Qaeda terrorist attacks on the U.S. on 9/11. In the two decades that followed, the U.S. has prosecuted what's called the War Against Terror in more than 80 nations. In these post-9/11 wars, over 800,000 people have died, at a cost to the United States of more than $6.4 trillion, as reported by the Costs of War Project at Brown University. Now a new report from the Costs of War Project finds that 37 million people have fled their homes in the eight most violent wars the U.S. military has launched or participated in since 2001. The millions of people who were displaced in U.S. wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Libya, and Syria, exceeds the number displaced in every war since 1900, except for World War II. Your reporter spoke with David Vine, professor of political anthropology at American University, and co-author of the project's report titled Creating Refugees, Displacement Caused by the United States' Post-9/11 Wars. Here, Professor Vine summarizes the report's findings and examines the ways in which he believes these wars have made the U.S. less secure.
In some ways, I'm sad to say that the cost of war project still exists. It has been in existence since 2011, and I've been a board member since that time. The aim of the project was to document the human and financial costs of the post-9/11 wars. When Catherine Lutz and a team of others at Brown University created the Cost of War Project, their hope was that the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and far beyond, that they would be over by now. But we are now almost at 19 years of war. Another year from now, we will see two decades of war. And although I think many of us hope that with a Biden-Harris administration, that there would be a responsible end to all of these wars. The United States has been fighting in at very least 24 countries since 2001, since George W. Bush announced a global war on terror. And the Cost of War Project has been, in a variety of ways, investigating what these wars have meant for the United States, for the world, for the countries where the wars have been fought. Most broadly, one of the reports that came out a year ago, the United States has spent, according to the Cost of War Project, $6.4 trillion, and that's trillion with a T, spent or obligated as of the end of this fiscal year, so just in the next month, which is a really incomprehensible sum. The report that I released with a team from my university, American University, and our public anthropology clinic, where it was a report that looked at how many people have been displaced by these wars, how many people have been forced from their homes, how many people have been turned into refugees and internally displaced people. And we focused actually just on the eight most violent wars that the United States has been engaged in, that eight most violent wars that the United States has either launched in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, or wars that the United States has escalated in the case of Libya and Syria, or wars where the United States has been a significant combatant in the case of Yemen, Somalia, and the Philippines. And we found that at a minimum, using a very conservative methodology, these wars have displaced 37 million people, which is, again, a very difficult sum to wrap one's brain around. 37 million people forced to flee their homes. And again, that's a very conservative estimate. The true total may be between 48 and 59 million people, which is more people displaced than in any war since the beginning of the 20th century, with the exception of World War II.
Professor Vine, there are politicians who backed these wars over these almost 20 years, and officials at the Pentagon that would justify what the United States undertook in terms of these conflicts, saying that these fights were necessary to make this nation safe from Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, Abu Sayyaf, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and a host of other Islamic terrorist organizations around the world. As you look at your study here and the numbers, horrendous numbers that we're talking about in terms of lives lost, people displaced, money spent, what's the cost-benefit analysis from your perspective here? There are many who would justify it.
I, for one, and I think probably most, if not all, of my colleagues at the Cost of War Project would not seek to engage in any sort of cost-benefit analysis involving human lives. But when you look at the human damage that's been wreaked by these wars, so in addition to the minimum 37 million displaced, the Cost of War Project has shown that around 800,000 people have died in direct combat just in five wars. So Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and that's just the part of the Syrian civil war where the United States has been involved, and Yemen. I'm flabbergasted by anyone who would seek to justify these wars or characterize them as anything short of catastrophe. And even that word doesn't seem to capture the breadth of, and depth of the damage. But the, you know, what has been the main or most immediate result of this war against terror and these wars, plural, against terror, it's been the creation of more groups, more individuals who would seek to do harm to the United States. The Islamic State is a product of the U.S. invasion and war in Iraq. It did not exist and would not have existed were it not for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And similarly, on 9/11, 2001, Al-Qaeda was a very small group, and there were very, very few groups like it. Since that time, groups like Al-Qaeda itself has grown, has morphed into the Islamic State in part, and has led to the creation of more groups like it. And I don't think there has been a proper reckoning with what these wars have meant. And, you know, think too about the $6.4 trillion that have been plowed into these wars, that have been spent on these wars. Think about what that money could have been spent on in the United States, the creation of jobs, universal health care, education, when we think about the poor state of schools and poor state of public schools through much of Connecticut. And you go on and on, the infrastructure. We could have used that money to build a green economy, to protect against global warming. And instead, the wars had been wasted, and worse than wasted, because they have taken so many lives, damaged so many lives, including the lives of U.S. military personnel, and which, of course, has affected the family members of U.S. military personnel. So the cost, the human costs, the financial costs have been broad and profound and really catastrophic.
That was David Vine, professor of political anthropology at American University. His forthcoming book is titled The United States of War. Find a link to the Costs of War Project report, Creating Refugees, Displacement Caused by the United States Post-9/11 Wars, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Global Community Radio in Geneva, New York, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KGHI in Westport, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.